Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Listening in on Surveillance this morning, I have to say Bloomberg News International Economics and Policy Correspondent Mike McKee, he noted how this morning's CPI report probably the most watched and most benign report because there are a couple more before the Fed meets next on September 20th. But nonetheless, and he said focus on the month to month, not the year over year, that was important.
Did you do that?
I did.
Okay, good.
All right, so let's get more on today's data set because we've got a great duo, I should say, with us. Because we should point out that headline number, right, posting its smallest back-to-back increases in 2 years. That was important, Tim.
That was really important. Let's get into it with this roundtable that we have. We got Nikki Baird, Vice President of Strategy at Aptus, on Zoom from Littleton, Colorado. And with us here in the studio is Bloomberg News Economics Editor Molly Smith. She's with us in the Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. Molly, I want to start with you because
she was the one swaying to
this. This is like your Super Bowl every month. This is like your U.S. Open every month.
Oh, well, let's not go that far, Tim. I still got the rest of August.
But we've talked a lot about the highlights and the takeaways. Any surprises to you in here?
Not really. I mean, and I know that's bad for ratings. We shouldn't say that this was not surprising.
But honesty is the best policy.
As expected, I've been told that's not good to say on the air, but it was true. And, you know, I always look for an opportunity to knock Mike McKee, but he was right. You know, focus on the month to month. Don't pay attention to that little pickup in the year over year. And it was pretty much as expected. I think for me, I was surprised to see that shelter was 90% of the increase. I mean, I know it's been a lot.
That's not normal, right?
I mean, it's been running at definitely maybe we've seen it run for like 2/3 of the increase. Okay. But now seeing it at 90, I mean, if anything, to me, that just sounds like the disinflation in other categories is really happening and just in shelter taking a bit more time.
Yeah, more targeted. Let's bring in our other guest with us, as we said, Nikki Baird, Vice President of Strategy at Aptos on Zoom from Colorado. So, Nikki, from your perspective and what you look at and what this all means for the consumer, what's kind of front and center for you?
Yeah, I think what Molly said is right in line. It's like this isn't something that on its own is going to have an impact on consumer spending or consumer behavior. We're already in the back to school season. We're looking ahead, of course, to the holiday season, ever important for retail. And this one indicator isn't enough to say that there's anything drastic that's going to happen to consumer spending between now and the end of the year.
Okay. Why is that?
Well, the price increases that have been happening, they do, especially in the things that impact their discretionary spending, those are leveling off, which is great news for everybody. I think what's more important to watch is we have the consumer, the student loan debt repayment starting up. That could potentially show up in things like Halloween spending, for example. That might be an important leading indicator going into the holiday season. If consumers is a very discretionary kind of spend, and it's exactly the kind of spend that is made by the people who are going to be most impacted by that kind of debt repayment. Those are the kinds of things that we're looking at to understand how much there is the impact on consumer spending going into that all important holiday season.
I have to say, just one anecdotal individual, things are still expensive. And I feel it when I go to the grocery store, I feel like everything in my world just doesn't matter. It's expensive. Super core prices, Molly. I want to come back to that because I saw on the blog this morning, I think it might've been Ari Jersey or somebody else pointing out, which is super core prices, closely watched by the Fed when it comes to inflation, rose in the 12 months through July in the first acceleration this year. It's service prices is minus energy and housing, right? Which follows a June reading that increased at the slowest pace in 18 months. So it sounds a little erratic, down and then up. So do you disregard it, or how do you see that?
I mean, I think that's kind of the overall story of the inflation as a whole, right? You know, that like we've all known that like the path down to 2% is going to be long and it's going to be bumpy. So I would put this in that same camp. And like the increase in June, that was the smallest in 18 months. Is that what you said?
Yeah, yeah.
So that was 4%. This month was 4.1. So kind of like, okay, like not really.
Split hairs?
Yeah. You know, it's kind of like the same with the headline, you know, being up, you know, 3.2 this month. It was up 3% last month. And a lot of that due to the base effects conversation.
But there is something to the effect that as we get closer to that 2%, right, it's tougher in terms of bringing the inflation down?
Yeah, and it's going to be in those, exactly, those super core services, ex-housing categories that are the most concerning. Those are the ones that are the stickiest price pressures. And, you know, a lot of the disinflation we've had so far has been kind of the unwinding of, like, the pandemic inflation pressures that we had. It's been some, like, easing of, like, the pressures from the war in Ukraine. So It's still debatable of how much the Fed's work has really brought about disinflation.
Hey, that's a really good point, and I want to ask Nikki what her thoughts are on or concerns are when it comes to energy prices on the rise again.
Yeah, I mean, again, from a consumer spending perspective, anything that eats up that discretionary budget is going to be the things that really drive whether or not consumers spend. I think, you know, what we've seen up till now is that consumers have been willing to accumulate debt in order to keep and maintain their spending levels. And I think it's a great point, like they're spending just as much, but net wise, they're actually buying less because their purchase power just doesn't go as far with all these sustained high prices. But I think that, you know, that idea of being able to continue to finance some of this consumer spending with some of the debt that consumers have been using before, that's starting to come to an end. Energy prices, and again, you know, the interest rate on that credit card debt, all of that stuff is going to come into play much more in terms of where consumers can go and how they can continue to impact and support the economy.
Following up on that, Nikki, we actually had the CEO of VantageScore in here today. They're a provider of credit scores to millions of Americans. And he was making a lot of similar points that you were just saying. And something that he's actually said on Bloomberg TV before is that the resumption of student loan payments, get this, is going to have a bigger impact on Americans than a Fed rate increase will.
Like, so a 125 basis point increase has less of an effect on
than the resumption of payments.
Yeah. I mean, that makes sense because if you think about the what the average student loan payment
is, out of your pocket, right?
Right.
Exactly. So if you're not spending that money, you know, if you don't have that money anymore because it's going to student loan payments, then it's not going to goods and services.
Yeah. I mean, Nikki, what do you think about that? You think he's like on it with the terms of the comparison there?
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I think the basis points rates, those increases take a little bit of time before they actually filter down to the consumer, right? It's not like today it was this and the Fed raises it and then the very next day that's impacting the rate that consumers are paying. It takes a little while for that to flow through. But that loan repayment, that's like immediate budget hit. It doesn't matter what the interest rate is. It's a repayment on something that you were able to take off the table in terms of budget before that now you have to put right back in. So if you combine adding that in and then you look at those other factors that can potentially impact consumer spending, like energy prices, like housing prices, the shelter inflation still is making up most of that increase. Those are things that are going to shrink the budget that consumers have for anything else.
Nikki, you work with the retail industry, all different types. A lot of it is about technology, innovation. That's, you know, your background, and you've covered this for a long time. I am curious, though, what you're hearing from your retail clients right now when it comes to the environment, hiring, consumer trends.
Yeah, labor costs are still really high, and there's been no give back in that regard for frontline workers in any place. So whether the labor market is soft or whether it's, you know, continuing to chug along, you know, the effective hourly rate that a lot of retailers are paying to staff, I mean, I see advertisements in windows in the Denver area for $15, $17, $20 an hour for a part-time frontline retail job. So that part of it is definitely still impacting their business very much so. I would say the other factor that historically was impacting inflation seems to be easing up, which is on the supply chain side. So we're definitely seeing where supply chains have evened out. There might be some weird things like sriracha or that come along and disrupt very specific things. But overall and in general, I would say that the supply chain issues and the shortages that really impact the price rises of 2021 and 2022,
right,
those definitely seem to be smoothed out.
Just got about 45 seconds. Quickly, Nikki, are we going to see more of what we see in Zara, where you dump stuff into a bin and it comes up on a monitor and we don't need workers and I'm taking off the security tags?
Uniqlo does it too.
Uniqlo has definitely been a forerunner there. You know, it's both of those companies kind of went on their own to kind of drive that innovation, and the rest of the technology industry hasn't completely caught up with that. So I do think that we can get to that point, but I think there's going to be a delay. They like custom built their own solutions to do that.
Soon I'm going to be back in the stock room. Real quickly, Molly Smith just got about 15, 20 seconds. What's your next focal point?
Oh, goodness. I think we've got PPI tomorrow, right? Hopefully.
Is that really a focal point?
I mean, look, it's another inflation point. You know, it's another thing before September. And then I guess Jackson Hole. Oh. But the U.S. Open, obviously, way more important.
Wait a minute. Yeah. Okay, good.
We can't talk to Molly Smith and not talk about the U.S.
And
Open.
I can tell you already there's going to be crowds. And if you want to look for a sign of consumer spending at the higher end, it's going to be
there. The tickets are already sold out for some days.
What do we think the Honey Deuce is going for?
Molly Smith, Nikki Bard, thank you so much. Over at Aptos, this is Bloomberg.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern. Listen on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, and the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
We're going to talk a little bit more about Tapestry. As Charlie mentioned, you know who they are. They own Coach, Kate Spade, you know, used to be Coach, but rebranded a few years ago.
I was going to say, I don't know if everyone knows who they are. I think like when this rebranding happened, Carol, I was like, I'm going to have such a hard time keeping Capri and Tapestry straight and like what companies they own.
I was going to like, I feel like I'm going to age myself, although I was young or it was my older sister's album, but Carole King and Tapestry, like every time I see it, I'm like, Tapestry, that's all I can think of that album. Anyway, yes, Capri Holdings, though, it was created by Michael Kors. It owns Versace. It owns Jimmy Choo. So it definitely is kind of your higher end $8.5 billion deal, as Charlie laid out. And so we are seeing some movement when it comes to luxury goods. I feel like that has certainly been a bright spot when it comes to retail. Although, forgive me, Coach and Kate Spade, not inexpensive, but I don't know if I put that in the same category as something like an LVMH.
Ooh. Well, I'm glad you brought them up because that is the context here, right? Taking on the European rivals. And we got a great group to really talk us through it. Bloomberg News U.S. luxury retail and personal care industries reporter Jeanette Newman joins us on the phone from New York City. And our Bloomberg Intelligence team, Deborah Aitken, senior analyst who covers global luxury goods, home, beauty, and personal care. She joins us on the phone from London. Hey, Jeanette, I just want to start with you. Give us the context here, some of the deal terms, but also the context that you and the team wrote about on the consumer team earlier today.
Yeah, thank you so much. And I also love the Tapestry album as well. I will just I will join you on that. I think some of the context here is just that, you know, Coach went into the pandemic much stronger than Michael Kors and has come out of the pandemic much stronger than Michael Kors. And we're seeing that, you know, in the sense that now Coach's parent company is taking over Michael Kors. And I think some of the reasons for that, I mean, you know, keep in mind, going back a decade, these companies used to be kind of head-to-head competitors. And Coach has really pulled ahead of Michael Kors. It's been able to raise prices, raise its brand cachet. It's done that through, some clever designs. It's renovated its stores, whereas Michael Kors has struggled a bit more. It's still very present in some kind of lower end department stores. As you both mentioned, I mean, Michael Kors is more mass market. Coach is not, you know, at the level of competing with some of the LVMHs of the world, but it's definitely been able to charge more for its handbags. And both of these companies, you know, together now, I mean, they'll completely dominate the U.S. handbag market here in the U.S.
Well, Deborah, we want to bring you into this. As we mentioned, senior analyst who covers global luxury goods, home, beauty, and personal care for our Bloomberg Intelligence team. She's on the phone in London. Deborah, how do you see this deal? And is it about the Michael Kors brand? Is it about Jimmy Choo? Is it about Versace? Is it all of it? Like, how are you thinking about this?
Hi. So they all have their place, but when we think about Michael Kors, 70% of the business, you know, the purchase price there, it's about really reinventing the Michael Kors brand. Management to do. So I see that the U.S. will be the big market and the fixed market in digital and in wholesale. But also, you know, there's much more to do elsewhere. And I just feel that Michael Kors has lost its way. It really reinvented itself a few years ago, and then I felt it became too saturated in the marketplace, and there's more to do. And I feel that the data composition and the way that digital works and the way that, if we think about the way that Tapestry works, that they depend less on wholesale accounts, which has really felt the pain in the U.S., in the last few months, then that could be beneficial. The other side of it for me is that there's a lot to do with Versace and Jimmy Choo. They're not sizable. Mm-hmm. There was always a comment that Versace could double and that it should be doing more in Europe too. Mm-hmm. And it gives a footprint for Tapestry into that luxury market, which is so much more profitable and much faster growth.
Jeanette, I want to bring you back in. I'm looking at Tapestry down about 16%. It's pretty much its lows of the day. And Capri, no surprise, as being the target here, is just
and at quite a premium, right?
At quite a premium, right, in terms of this deal. I mean, it's up 55%. I'm looking at, it's an $8.5 billion deal, and we're looking at a market cap of $6.3 billion. So, you know, it's just kind of interesting in terms of some of the financials. Tapestry shares, not surprising for it to be down as the acquirer, but it seems like a lot. Is that investor saying you paid too much?
I think part of it is investors questioning how easy it will be for Tapestry to turn around the Michael Kors brand, which has some of the, you know, the problems that Deborah laid out, right? I mean, Tapestry is essentially Coach. Coach is the majority of its revenue, and Capri is essentially Michael Kors. That's the bulk of its revenue, something around like 70%. And as Deborah said, it's been a brand that's been struggling. And so to make this deal really work, Tapestry has to turn around Michael Kors. And, you know, people would say, okay, well, the executives at Tapestry, they've been able to turn around the Coach brand. You know, think about the Coach brand a decade ago and think mm-hmm. of where it is now. It's really elevated it. But the question is still there, you know, whether they'll be able to turn around the Michael Kors brand. And keep in mind, you know, they turned around Coach They did an okay job turning around Kate Spade, although that's still a work in progress. They did not turn around Stuart Weitzman, their other brand. That's kind of in the dumps. And now they're taking on three more brands. So the question is still there if they'll be able to kind of take this successful Coach playbook and apply it to Michael Kors. Well, they've obviously are juggling a lot of other new companies that they've acquired.
Jeanette, any regulatory risk here?
I think that's a question that's been raised, and we'll have to see. I mean, this some of the data that we have from Global Data and Analysts at Global Data, you know, these two companies combined will be the fourth largest luxury company in the world with a market share of around 5.1%. In the Americas, they'll be the second largest player behind LVMH. So that those numbers make people think that's not as much of a concern, but that is still a to be sure.
Deborah, as an analyst who's covering this sector, and I do wonder how much time do you think, you know, investors need to give Tapestry to be able to kind of figure out how they turn around the Kors brand, knowing maybe some of the problems. I have to say, I feel like I see Kors everywhere, and I feel like it's a little saturated. Maybe that's part of the problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would say this is a 2 to 3 year fix. I mean, it's not set to complete until calendar 24. So we probably see by maybe end of first quarter 24 that this deal completes through. And from there, we wait 2 years for 200 million of synergies to move through. We end up, I think, with an adjusted EBITDA margin on the back of that. That's probably 150 basis points and gets it to mid-teens operating margin. But versus some of those peers, that appears that still isn't enough. So for me, I think it's a 2 to 3 year process, and I feel that standalone Capri, given where the debt was and how it needed to turn everything, that it maybe is better within this portfolio because of that wholesale adaptation of the model, because of the data capture, because of working more closely
right.
with digital. There's a big difference between these. But the other side of it is I actually feel that it, in the price that this was going to happen. And when we say, you know, stocks are very much today, trail back over a year, and we're looking at a mix of buy and hold on our function, looking at potential price targets, mm-hmm. just about above an ad when we're looking at recommendation.
Right.
But that price target was $70. And I know that we've now... over 60% of the market was into the North America, which is cooled down.
Got it.
But it's not for everyone. It's into the biggest.
Hmm. Yeah. Deborah Aiken of our Bloomberg Intelligence team and Jeanette Newman, of course, of Bloomberg News, who both of them, of course, following this space.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, the Bloomberg Business app, and YouTube. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
Tim, got to say, went straight to the CDC website for the stats on this and found each year approximately 30,000 cases of Lyme disease are reported to the CDC by state health departments and the District of Columbia. However, this number doesn't reflect every case, and I guess they say it could be, if you use different estimates and methodology, I'll get it out, could be as much as almost 500,000 people may get Lyme disease every year in the U.S.
Because the other issue, and we're going to talk about this for the next, you know, 10 minutes.
Yeah.
The other issue is that these cases don't necessarily all present symptoms in the same way.
Exactly.
There's no clear definition coming from medical professionals.
All right, so let's get to it. Nicole Baumgarth is with us, professor of molecular microbiology and immunology at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, which, as you know, supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Nicole joining us on Zoom in Baltimore. Nicole, nice to have you here with us. Lyme disease summer, I think about it. I'm up in, you know, if you're up in Connecticut or out in the woods, like, you know that this is something you need to think about it. Tell us, though, from your perspective, how bad really... I can talk about cases, but how bad is it? And as Tim said, it's not necessarily the same thing for everyone. And what does bad mean in terms of the impact it has on individuals?
Yes, thank you for having me and for this topic. I think you're raising a very important point, which is that in most cases, individuals who get bitten by a tick and develop Lyme disease will go to their GP and get the necessary antibiotics and will recover fully. But a small subset of patients do not. And that could be because maybe their diagnosis was delayed. They may not have known that they had a tick bite. All because of some genetic predisposition that we don't really fully understand, and they develop disease that can be very debilitating. It can lead to long-term consequences. So people talk about having brain fog, not being able to concentrate, developing neurological symptoms, and unable to function. And that really is life-changing for these individuals.
Professor, I've talked to people who have had Lyme disease, and they tell me the resistance that they came up against in their diagnosis from the medical community about being diagnosed. And I'm wondering if you can speak to that at all, and if that's changed in recent years as we've become, you know, more aware of it and more aware of the symptoms.
Yeah, I think it has changed. I mean, I think where the resistance was never to, you know, you appear at your GP's office and say you've seen a tick, or you've been out in the woods and now you display these symptoms. You may even have that very distinct bullseye rush. GPs would immediately come to the conclusion that in all likelihood you have Lyme disease. It's really those protracted cases where you have these very non-specific symptoms of feeling tired and having this brain fog and having pains and aches that are really hard to pinpoint, so very non-specific, and then not having this history of having been out in the woods, not being able to make this connection where people really are resistant. And you know, if the diagnosis is protracted, you may have been out in the woods, but you don't recall, because it's now weeks and months ago, and many of us go hiking frequently. So that is really where the non-specific nature of the symptoms, and we don't really have a really good diagnostic. And some of the patients that are being diagnosed don't come up with a positive diagnosis.
There's no test, or the test just, yeah, I mean, forgive me, but I don't know much about this.
Yes,
there's no test, or the test doesn't show, you know, the test isn't conclusive.
So when there is a test, and it's actually two tests, and you have to be positive in both tests in order to be qualified by CDC criteria of having Lyme disease, the problem comes when only one of the tests shows up positive, or the test doesn't show exactly, you know, isn't positive for all the criteria. So it's not a very simple yes, no test like we're used to, like with the COVID test. It's a little more complicated. And so so that is when the problem comes in. And that, again, goes back to patients maybe having had the infection, but a long time ago. And so it's not so clear to diagnose them using this test. So the test, a positive test is always clear. But when they're tested negative, you don't know whether it's really means you haven't had Lyme disease.
Hey, one thing I'm curious, whether it's Lyme disease or something else, Nicole, are you thinking more and more about just the world's getting really populated and we are increasingly pushing animals out of their normal domains and just living closer and closer to them? Is this just kind of part of the problems, whether it's Lyme disease or other illnesses, if you will?
It clearly has to do. It has to do with, you know, climate change. Ticks are on the move. You know, they're moving because it's warmer now, and areas, they can move into areas that they previously didn't find hospitable for them. And it is what you said, this sort of us getting out there in areas that we previously weren't out. And so we are really getting into the life cycle that has been evolutionarily established over a very long period of time. And we are sort of interrupting them as much as they're interrupting us.
When I was preparing for this, there's actually a map on the CDC website that shows Lyme disease cases over time by different states. And you can start it 20 years ago, back in 2001, and see the way that it's migrated. It's pretty remarkable, and not in a good way. So, Professor, I'm wondering about vaccine here, because my understanding is that Pfizer's working on something and it's been delayed, but it's in stage three trials right now. What can you tell us about a vaccine for Lyme disease?
I think it's absolutely doable. As I heard the banter before I came on, yes, we are giving it to our pets, right? Dogs can get a Lyme vaccine, horses can get a Lyme vaccine. And so I think it's absolutely doable to develop one. I'm very excited about the clinical trial. It has been delayed and there have been some problems. So I hope it will go forward and give us good results. The challenge with any vaccine is that because, you know, we're getting now into the colder months, so the number of Lyme disease cases is going down. This is obviously a challenge for a vaccine to show efficacy, which is really, can we reduce the number of cases of Lyme disease in the population that got vaccinated? So it's a measure of how many people do we vaccinate, right? And then how many of them would normally get Lyme disease. So it's not a straightforward clinical trial, but I'm very hopeful that it will show hopefully efficacy.
Because I have a really silly question, because I do think about my dogs, and, you know, flea and tick, and there's medicine we give. It used to be some chemicals on the back, and now it's a pill that's got like all these different things. I mean, if we can do it with pets, why has it kind of taken so long for us to maybe do something for humans? And if it's not safe for my pet, maybe I don't want to be giving it to my pet.
Yeah, I mean, we don't want to go into all the, but I mean, there was a vaccine on the market, of course, over 20 years ago that was taken off the market, but it wasn't taken off the market because of low efficacy. There was an idea that it may cause side effects that we didn't want. So,
my understanding is those were unfounded and it came at a time where there was a lot of skepticism about vaccines.
Absolutely correct. Yes, it turned out to be unfounded, but I think once you have that doubt that something may be done, you don't want to give something that's supposed to prevent a disease and cause a disease, right? So to err on the side of caution, I think, and really, yeah, to not have the headaches of people going after you for trying to give a vaccine. I think people, the company pulled it off the market, which I think overall, it's unfortunate, right?
Right.
We're seeing rise in cases. We need to really develop a vaccine.
We have 30 seconds left. Just give us three tips on how to stay safe from ticks for the remainder of the summer.
Yes, wear long-sleeved pants and shirts, and you know, be a goof and put your socks, your trousers into your socks. And
that's how I roll anyway.
It does.
Check yourself after you arrive home for ticks and your loved ones as well. And maybe have a shower because some ticks, you can, before they're fully attached, you might be able to shower them away.
We feel like little monkeys at home because we're always checking each other.
Yeah, you got to do that.
And gosh, I've spent hours pulling ticks from my dog. Nicole Baumgart, she is molecular microbiology and immunology professor at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Thank you so much for joining us.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus global business, finance, and tech news. The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
Haley Berg is back with us, lead economist at the travel app Hopper, and she joins us on Zoom from Boston. First of all, Haley, we got that CPI print. We did see airline prices coming down. Talk to us about the environment right now and what's going on in terms of pricing.
When we look at the domestic market, a lot of what we're seeing this year is being driven by increased capacity from airlines. We typically see a pretty tight relationship between fares and how many seats are available to book. Right now, we're above 2019 levels. There are more seats available to book on domestic airlines now than there were at this time in 2019. That combined with better jet fuel prices, down significantly from last year, still a ways to go compared to 2019, and demand opening up to international destinations, all has combined and has really added to a seasonal effect. Typically, fares drop at this time of the year, But that's being compounded by this increase in supply, shift in demand, and some relief on costs. And that's how we end up with prices about 10% lower than last year and versus 2019.
So did the international tickets, or are they just like totally exempt from this? We're seeing, since demand is so high, international is continuing to be expensive.
International remains extremely expensive on long haul routes. Hmm. Think fares to Asia, well over $1,400, up almost 60%.
That's an economy?
That would be an average, what we call a good deal price. So an economy, basic economy ticket, pretty much anything excluding first or business.
Okay.
All right. So Asia, what about Europe specifically?
Europe was very expensive this summer, peaks over $1,400 a ticket, but we have seen significant improvement in the last couple of weeks. Some of that is seasonal. Some of that is supply. Airlines have gotten back to about 97% of 2019 capacity. So we have seen demand shift back international. If it feels like everyone you know is in Italy, it's because they probably are.
You're like the third person. You're like the third person to say that to me in 24 hours.
You're so, everybody's going.
Like if you open up Instagram, apparently. Yeah. Where's the place to go? Sicily? Is it like because of the White Lotus?
We are definitely seeing some of what we call set jetting. So Palermo and Taormina in Sicily are very popular, but then some of the usual suspects. We see the Amalfi Coast, Rome and Milan, Lake Como, very popular this time of year.
So what happens? Does it stay this way? Or then once we start to get closer to holidays, we start to see an uptick?
On the domestic front, we have a couple more weeks of these low fares. We're expecting them to bottom out this month. And then they'll start rising in late September, early October, when travelers are starting to plan those trips for Thanksgiving and Christmas. And we'll see them rise back to reach about pre-pandemic levels in December. We'll pretty much match where we were in 2019 and 2022 in December, about $280 a ticket if you're booking something at the end of the year.
Okay, so when should we be booking for holidays?
Not yet. It's too
really?
Early.
It's too Everyone early.
Everyone is feeling trigger happy, but the sweet spot for booking your trips home for the holidays is actually from about September 14th to October 14th. So that 4-week window at the end of September and early October, fares for trips home for the holidays, they start incredibly high in the summer. You'd be paying about 20% more than previous years if you booked right now. But if you wait, they're going to come down during that sweet spot. That's really when you want to book.
So you're saying if I've got a kid to bring back home overseas because of college overseas, I got to book that ticket pretty soon.
Yes. International fares for the holidays, you'll want to book between now and probably the end of September. So you've got a couple weeks,
do
maybe 2 months.
You got to tell her now or else she won't do it.
It's a nonstop ticket on a popular route, and you see a good deal, definitely go for it.
You know what's funny, though? The kids haven't even left yet for their trip.
Well, that's what I was saying. She's here right now.
Yeah.
What about hotels and, I don't know, cruises? What are some of the other things that you're seeing when it comes to travel and costs?
Hotels are still pretty expensive. Prices are about 10, 11% higher than this time last year, about $180 a night for a U.S. hotel. But something to keep in mind is travel behavior. We are definitely travelers now who are planning a little bit more last minute when it comes to flights. That's actually a good thing for hotel booking. Mm-hmm. Booking hotels at the last minute, as long as it's not a major resort that sells out early, can actually save you about 25% off of peak prices because most people plan ahead. If you're booking the last couple of days before check-in, hotels drop prices. Can actually save a significant amount if you're a procrastinator.
I want to go back to the fuel costs and to what extent fuel costs have to do with high ticket prices. Do you know, Haley, what portion of an airline ticket is accounted for in fuel costs? Or I should say, what portion of a ticket, you know, is made up of fuel costs?
It varies by airline, depending on, you know, their operational expenses in general, but also whether they're hedged. Mm. But traditionally, we've seen somewhere between 15 and 30% of operational expenses coming from fuel. It also differs by domestic and international. Those long haul routes are less efficient with fuel. But typically, you know, if we see a 10% increase in jet fuel prices, for example, we might expect about 3% of that to be passed on to 3 percentage of that 10% passed on to consumers.
Haley, just got 30 seconds. Any signs of recession in the data and what you are seeing and the trends that you are seeing?
We have been looking for it for maybe 18 months now, and I can say we still have not seen weakness in demand, in spending, in what we hear from our users on the Hopper app. On the whole, we're hearing we're spending more than we have historically, we're taking more trips, and we're also seeing that in the data, what our bookers are actually doing. So seem to see strength in travel continuing.
I'm just going to say, we have to go, but I'm just going to get on a little rant here. The airports are too crowded.
They are.
They're gross.
Yeah.
Being on an airplane is no fun unless you're at the front of the plane. It's miserable, and yet we pay through the nose for it.
You are a crank, man.
It is like, when traveling with kids, the thing, young, it's like, you
know. It is hard. It's very difficult. It's
like, you expect me to change a diaper here?
And then when you
kids baby get cry, dirty.
The little one cries in there, everybody's like, hey.
I don't care.
I know you.
They're fine.
Haley Berg, lead economist over at Hopper. Thank you so much. This is Bloomberg.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization. We live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Yeah, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
You drive me crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, TikTok, everybody. Just about 17 and a half minutes left in today's trading session. Carol Masser, along with Tim Stenovic, live in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio on YouTube and Bloomberg Originals. And I think Romain said it really well in terms of the bouncing around that we are seeing. Certainly on the equity trade, I feel like that's been going on throughout the week, Tim. But you got yields. They're kind of high.
It's kind of wild today, Carol.
Higher, I should say.
You look at the NASDAQ, for example. And it was up as much as 0.7%.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Earlier today.
Yeah.
Down. Now down.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Kind of flat.
I know.
I think we're going to live from data point to data point, and we're also going to wait until kind of the next Fed meeting. I feel like that's going to be our life for a little bit. But let's see what Aaron Kennan says. He's much smarter than me, that's for sure, and is in it. He is, of course, co-founder and CEO at Clear Harbor Asset Management. They've got about $1 billion in assets under management. Joining us once again on Zoom from Stamford, Connecticut. Hey, Aaron, good to have you back with us. It is an interesting market, but let's have some, Tim always reminds me, got to take a longer view, step out a little bit in the perspective. We've had quite a run, certainly, when it comes to some of those big tech names and the NASDAQ overall, and also the S&P. So a little bit of churn maybe is to be expected.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thanks for having me back, Tim, Carol.
we've gone a long way year to date, and what a change from 2022 for sure. But you know, if you look at just this earnings season that we're still sort of wading through, but we're more on the tail end of it. You know, I think the reality is that many companies have, or the most of the companies have, beaten expectations. But when you look at year over year earnings growth, not much has changed. And so those expectations have been exceeded, which is something that we all welcome. But markets haven't reacted, you know, dramatically as a whole to the earnings cycle. And I think, you know, the market's trying to figure out whether or not a PE multiple for the S&P 500 at 20 times anticipated 2023 full year earnings is the right multiple given the current environment.
Do you think it's the right multiple?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think the bond market is signaling two different responses to that. And I always sort of, you know, peer into the bond market to try to help me answer that question, Tim. The inversion of the yield curve suggests that a recession is, in fact, around the corner, whether it's the back half of this year or perhaps the front half of next year. But nominal rates are actually higher on a year-to-date basis, which is sort of a little bit of a conundrum for those who are trying to extract tea leaves from what the bond market is telling us right now. We think, you know, when you look at the trajectory of inflation, we saw CPI this morning, and, you know, a year and 1 month ago, we're at 9% headline, and now we're at 3.2%. So we've come a long way. And the Fed, if you look at Fed funds futures, looks like it's on hold. I think there's only like a 10% chance of a move in September. And so, you know, it's just sort of interesting, particularly with the significant, I think the most significant short interest in the Treasury market that we've seen in my lifetime, where we are right now, where the bond market's sort of signaling that maybe we're not all clear on inflation, maybe growth remains stronger than expected, and the equity market is a little more sanguine on that point.
So PE multiple, how reliable, how much do you use it as kind of an indicator, a reliable indicator of where we go from here?
It's not first of all, you have to look at which components of the equity market we're looking at when we talk about PE multiples, because it's where have we come from in PEs, where we may be going, what's the historical basis for PEs. If you think we're going into a deep recession, PE multiples for the S&P 500 tend to bottom at 14 times, 15 times. So, you know, that's an anchoring point. If you believe in hard landing, market's certainly not pricing that in. You also have to think about PE multiples within sectors. You know, you look at Europe, you look at, you know, a heavily industrial banking focused part of the equity market. Well, naturally, PE multiples, because it's a lower growth segment of the market and the economy, are going to be lower. So it's not healthy for one to sort of look through the S&P at 20 times and compare it to the European market that has far less technology and therefore growth exposure.
Okay, so I ask you this question all the time, Aaron. Someone comes to you with money. How do you deploy it right now?
Well, you know, oftentimes people come to us with capital that's invested. You know, we're very cognizant of tax implications. I would just say this. Based on where we think inflation is moving, we are incrementally more bullish on taking a bit more duration risk in fixed income here. In other words, extending out into fixed income, owning high-grade fixed income. That means to us treasuries, mortgage-backed securities, and maybe even some investment-grade credit exposure. On the equity side, we still believe in diversification. We think there are opportunities across multiple sectors. We're just not, given the current valuation in the market, we're not poised to sort of increase our targets here, but we do believe in equities for the long haul, and that's a philosophy that we've always embraced here at Clear Harbor.
Hey, on the treasuries or the fixed income side, what kind of duration? You said you're willing to go out a little bit. How far out?
Yeah. Well, if you look at the Bloomberg Aggregate Bond Index, which is the primary benchmark of the fixed income market, it has an average weighted maturity of about 8.5 years, maybe a little more than that. And of course, you know, it seems like Mr. Market in fixed income is hugging the front end of the market right now because treasury bills are well over 5%. Mm-hmm. And the yield to maturity of the Bloomberg aggregate is only about 4.9%. But if you think the Fed is sort of done or about done, we think this is a good time to at least nudge your average maturity and duration further out the curve. So it depends on the client, depends on you know, what the objectives are, but just moving it out. If your average maturity is now 1 year, you know, maybe you can move it out to 2 or 3. If you can move it out to 8.5 and you're at 2 now, maybe you move it out to 4 or 5, you know. So, you know, it's making those sort of incremental shifts right now, given the sort of risk reward that we see right in the market.
Right, which maybe explains too where I think, was it the 30-year today? The Treasury auction didn't go as well as I think some of the auctions earlier in the week, maybe some of that longer duration. Aaron, thank you so much. We got to run. Be well. Aaron Kennan, co-founder, CEO at Clear Harbor Asset Management, over $1 billion in assets under management, joining us on Zoom from Stamford, Connecticut. You look like you're thinking about something.
Yeah. I was looking at the wrong column. The NASDAQ was higher by 1.6% earlier today. I remember it was surging this morning. You and I were recording our weekend show.
Yeah.
I said, look at the markets.
We popped. We popped, and now we're
yeah.
The easy inflation print, I think, made everybody. I know.
Then what happens?
Higher for longer.
Oh, that's new news.
I told you. Did you get the memo?
I got the memo.
All right, guys, stick around. More to come, certainly, here on Bloomberg Business Week. Carol Masser, along with Tim Stenovic, and this is Bloomberg Radio.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 3 to 6 Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.